Yeah, so thanks very much, Ricky, but it's very difficult to live up to an introduction like that, but I'm gonna give it a try. So I thought it would be a good idea to talk in a non-technical way about how Bitcoin works, because I think a lot of people, even people who may even own some Bitcoin, don't really understand what a Bitcoin is. However, when I set myself that task, it was about as difficult as explaining in one lecture how atomic bombs work, okay? Or how a computer works to somebody who's never seen a computer. It's extraordinarily difficult to do. I don't know if I'm going to succeed, but I'll be able to tell from the looks on your faces by the end of the talk if I have. What I'm going to do is play a video. This video is available on YouTube. It's very enjoyable to watch. I don't think it explains very much, but you're going to like it. It's quite short. Then, maybe at the end of the talk, if necessary, we'll play it again, because I think you'll have a very different level of understanding of what's going on. So let's give it a try here.
What is Bitcoin? Bitcoin is the first decentralized digital currency. Bitcoins are digital coins you can send through the internet. Compared to other alternatives, Bitcoins have a number of advantages. Bitcoins are transferred directly from person to person via the net without going through a bank or clearinghouse. This means that the fees are much lower, you can use them in every country, your account cannot be frozen, and there are no prerequisites or arbitrary limits. Let's look at how it works. Bitcoins are generated all over the internet by anybody running a free application called a Bitcoin miner. Mining requires a certain amount of work for each block of coins. This amount is automatically adjusted by the network such that Bitcoins are always created at a predictable and limited rate. Your Bitcoins are stored in your digital vault, which might look familiar if you use online banking. When you transfer Bitcoins, an electronic signature is added. After a few minutes, the transaction is verified by a miner and permanently and anonymously stored in the network. The Bitcoin software is completely open source and anybody can review the code. Bitcoin is changing finance the same way the web changed publishing. When everyone has access to a global market, great ideas flourish. Let's look at some examples of how Bitcoins are already used today. You can purchase video games, gifts, books, servers, and alpaca socks. Several currency exchanges exist where you can trade your Bitcoins for dollars, euros, and more. Bitcoins are a great way for small businesses and freelancers to get noticed. It doesn't cost anything to start accepting them, there are no chargebacks or fees, and you'll get additional business from the Bitcoin economy. For your first Bitcoins and more information, visit weusecoins.com.
Sounds great, doesn't it? It's pretty appealing to me. Before going on, what I should tell you is that I do not own any Bitcoin. And if you've come here seeking advice on whether you ought to invest in Bitcoin, you're not going to get it from me. You can draw your own conclusions from the presentation that I make, but I have no vested interest in this, unlike some people in the Bitcoin community who really do have an interest in seeing the values of Bitcoin's rise. In order to talk about whether Bitcoin is money or not, we have to talk about what money is. And there are basically three forms of it. One form that we're all familiar with is token money, something that is represented by a physical object. The physical object could be a familiar banknote, although I think there's some problem with these thousands these days. I think there's been some counterfeiting of $1,000 notes. And we're going to have to talk about the counterfeiting problem because the question would arise, can you counterfeit Bitcoin, for example? Okay? And, of course, the physical coin token. And tokens have the fantastically wonderful property that they can be transferred by physical transfer of ownership. So if I want to pay you, I take my coin and I give it to you, and you have it, and I no longer have it. There's no possibility of replicating the coin or having it multiply by, like, bacteria. There's one and only one of that coin. And so once I've divested of it, I don't have it anymore, and you have it. And then you can hand it over to somebody else. That's the good property of token money. A bad property, however, is that if you don't have the token, the value is lost. So if a thief takes it, he has it. You don't have it anymore. If the money burns up in a fire, it's gone. There are certain conditions under which you can get it back again, but you're probably not aware of those, and you probably haven't taken the necessary precautions to get the money back again. A benefit of token money is that there's no intermediary required for spending them. So if I want to buy something from you, I don't have to hand the money over to somebody else first and then have them hand it to you. It's a completely private transaction. And this is the reason that many illegal transactions take place in cash. Drug dealers, for example, favor cash. The reason for that is there is no intermediary, and there's no record made of the transfer, and there's no paper trail. There's no evidence left that they've made a payment. That's a benefit for them, but it's not necessarily a benefit for the financial authorities who are trying to control the currency. All token money requires faith in the issuer of the money. Usually the issuer is a government or a bank that is authorized by the government to issue the money. If you don't have faith in the issuer, then you probably are not interested in taking the money. So the faith in the ruble, the faith in the Russian government, recently went down because of its incursion into the Ukraine. What happened? The value of the ruble against other currencies went down because Russia now has undertaken possibly greater debt by a military incursion. They may not be able to meet their debts. And if they can't meet their debts, then their currency goes down and down and down, etc. Whereas governments that you have faith in, example, Hong Kong Monetary Authority has very conservative policies. The Hong Kong currency is remarkably stable. And that's because people have faith in the issuer. Now, if the issuer is not a government, for example, American Express traveler's checks. American Express is not a government, but people have faith in American Express because for over 100 years, it has never defaulted on its debts or payment of any traveler's check. But suppose I decide I want to start issuing traveler's checks. And my advantage over American Express is that I'm not even going to charge you a fee. You want a Seamus $100 traveler's check? It's only going to cost you $100. But if you go to American Express, it costs you $101. So I want everybody, please, to buy my traveler's checks. Would you do it? Let me tell you, you shouldn't. The reason you shouldn't is you shouldn't have the kind of faith in me that you have in American Express. Because when a merchant presents the check to me, I might not give him the money. I might not even have the money. I might have taken all of your money and planned an expensive vacation in South America. But American Express does not take expensive vacations in South America, or at least historically they've never done so. But again, it's faith in the issuer. Now, here's a second kind of money, notational money. Notational money is not represented by a physical object. It's represented by a notation in a ledger. And in the old days, it was your bank book, your passbook. You would go to the bank and you would deposit some money, and while you were standing there, they would revise the number in your passbook to show that you had more on deposit. And when you came to the bank to withdraw money, they would revise the entry in your passbook to show a lower balance. A bank account is notational money. It's not represented by any physical object. It's a promise by the bank that when you show up at the bank and ask for your money, they will give it to you. Again, you have to have faith in the maintainer of the ledger. If you don't have faith in the bank to deliver the money when you ask, you won't put your money in the bank. Notational money has the benefit that it can't be lost. A thief can't take it from you because it's only represented by a ledger. You're not holding anything. There's no token. But a disadvantage is, to spend notational money, an intermediary is required, a bank or a clearinghouse. Because if I have money in my bank account, the only way I can spend it is through the bank. I can write you a bank check. I can go online to the online banking site. I can cause money to leave my account and enter your account. There are many other ways in which you can do it, but it's always through the financial system. That means that all of those transactions are recordable, and they're reportable to a government. And this is why drug dealers don't write checks to each other. They use huge bundles of cash. Okay? But it requires faith in the maintainer of the ledger. If you don't have faith in the maintainer to keep an accurate ledger, then you won't put your money in the bank. And there's a third form of money. Hybrid money requires both the token and a ledger account. An example is a personal check. The personal check is a physical piece of paper. And if I pay you with one and you lose the check, you can't cash it. You might come complaining to me that you lost it. Would I please stop the check and would I issue another one? But in the meantime, you don't have the money. An octopus card. Similarly, you put money on an octopus card. If you lose the octopus card, then you don't have use of the money. Whether you can get it back or not depends on whether you have a registered one, etc. But you need the token. However, what you may or may not know is that the value that sits on your octopus card is replicated in a database held by Octopus Cards Limited. And there's a constant comparison going on. Every time you use the card online, there's a comparison between your balance on your card and a balance that's held by OCL. And if there's a discrepancy, for example, if you hack the system somehow and you add value to your Octopus card, you will be found out very quickly. Okay? Problem with hybrid money is it requires both faith in the issuer and it can be lost. So it has a combination of bad properties. Furthermore, it requires an intermediary for spending. That's going away a little bit with Octopus cards. I understand there are going to be purse-to-purse transfers with Octopus cards soon. Okay. So now you understand the different forms of money. There's a fourth kind. And that is virtual money, where there's no token and there's no ledger. There's even no issuer. There's no government backing. There's no government supervision or control. And no intermediary is required for spending. That's what virtual money would be. Question is it even possible? If it's possible, who would create the money? And why would it have the properties of money? And what are the properties of money? What makes something money? It's the ability to spend it. The ability to discharge debt with it. The ability to have other people accept it in return for goods and services. If you have something with those properties, we would call it money. If you have something else that doesn't have those properties, for example, I have a watch here. The watch has certain value, probably, not very much. It has value, but you wouldn't call my watch money. Because I can't walk into a store and buy something and say, here, take the watch for it. I would have to go sell it to somebody who buys watches, get cash, and then go to a store and sell it. So who's going to create this virtual stuff, and why is it going to have the properties of money? Furthermore, without a token and without a ledger, how would you ever know how much you had, and how would you ever know what its value was? And how do you spend it? And if you spend it, how do you know the person spending it with you is the true owner of it? How do you know it's not forged? How do you know it's not stolen? And what prevents you from spending the same money twice? If it has a digital representation, then one of the properties of computers is a copy of a file is identical bit for bit with the original file. And so if I emit a character string to you as money, I can keep the original character string and I can emit that to somebody else. And that's referred to as double spending. You cannot double spend a coin because once you give it up, you don't have it anymore. But you could potentially double spend anything that's digital. Okay? Now, in order to explain in a non-technical way what bitcoins are, I want to refer you to the problem of determining land ownership. This is an analogy that's not usually used in reference to bitcoin. Land. How do you know who owns a parcel of land? You could go up to a house and knock on the door, and if somebody answers, you could ask them, are you the owner of this property? But you can't rely on the answer because he may only be a renter, he may be a trespasser, or he may be the true owner. You don't know. How do you find out who owns land? Well, you go to the land registry. The land registry makes a record for every parcel of land in its jurisdiction. It maintains a record of ownership. The problem is that record of ownership is not so simple because people can sell land, and the way they sell land is by granting a deed. And so ownership of land is defined by what's referred to as a chain of title, which is a sequence of deeds, pieces of paper that are registered in the land registry, leading from the original owner to the present owner. So here is A. A was the original owner. He was granted to him by the government in 1650 or something. And he sells it to B. And we have to, of course, identify what plot of land it is. This is plot 456. And A sells to B. And that's recorded in the registry. Now, when B wants to sell it to C, or in this case to K, in order to check to make sure that B is really the owner, K sends his attorneys to the land registry, and they look at the chain of deeds. And they satisfy themselves that the most recent transfer was from A to B. And so they advise K that it's okay, B's really the owner of the land, you can pay him for it. Now you become the owner of the land by registering your title, etc., etc., etc. And we now can learn by following this chain that V is the present owner of the land. This is really what a Bitcoin is. You'll see in a minute. Deeds are recorded in the land registry. Ownership is determined by searching the registry. So the land registry is, in effect, a ledger holder. It's keeping track of ownership of land. If the registry is altered, for example, there's a rogue employee who works for the land registry, and he eliminates deeds, or he forges things and changes title. That can be a massively difficult and expensive thing to sort out. In fact, it may never be solved if he did it right. Okay? However, one thing that can happen is double selling is prevented if you timestamp the deeds. So suppose I purport to sell land to you, and your attorneys go check and they verify that I'm really the owner. Then I purport to sell land to you, and your attorneys check and find out that I'm really the owner. And so I emit two deeds and I get paid twice. Now, both of you go to the land office and you record your deed. Somebody's going to record the deed first. Once that's recorded, the second guy loses. Because at that point, I'm not the owner anymore. He's the owner. So the chain of title can prevent what you might think of as double spending. That is, trying to sell the same land to two different people. And double spending is a potential problem with Bitcoin, and that has to be solved, and it's going to be solved by the chain of title. Now, the problem with land registries is there's one central place where everything is recorded, and so you have to trust the land registry. Furthermore, if the government decides that it wants to redistribute land, it takes over the registry and does something. There's a centralized place for control. So let's dispense with the land registry. Let's say we're not going to have one at all, zero. What we're going to do instead is every time a deed is issued, we're going to broadcast the deed to thousands of nodes of a decentralized public network that nobody controls. These are in different countries all over the world, not subject to sovereign control of any single government. If the deeds are genuine and the network members agree on the chain of title, so I can follow the chain of title at this node, he can follow the chain of title, he can follow the chain of title, and then we can broadcast who we think the owner is. And if a majority agree that the owner is V, then he is. Like by definition in this decentralized land registry. There have to be enough honest members in this network so that false responses cannot dominate. Suppose more than half of the people get together and conspire and they just lie about the answer. So they say, no, it's not V that's the owner, it's W that's the owner. W happens to be one of them. That's a risk, and that's actually a risk in Bitcoin that was actually revealed in the original Bitcoin paper. The possibility that the decentralized network might end up under the control of hostile forces. But this registry is not under any centralized control. It would require conspiracy among more than half of the members to do anything bad. So it has some security properties associated with it. Okay, well, so much for land. Land is not portable. You can't carry it around with you, and you can't spend it. I can't go into a store and say, oh, you can take 5 square meters of my property in payment for this refrigerator. Okay? So we're going to do something different. I'm going to propose that we use valuable Scotch whiskey as money. Okay? I'm actually, just for full disclosure here, I can't stand Scotch. So I'm not promoting Scotch whiskey. You may or may not be aware that Johnny Walker XR is issued in limited numbered editions. Each bottle costs about $1,100 Hong Kong dollars. And there's a photo of one of the bottles of Johnny Walker XR. And you can see there's a label down there on the bottle. And I've blown it up. And there's actually a serial number on each bottle of Johnny Walker XR. Now, we can use Johnny Walker XR as money. If all of you like Scotch, and I want to buy something from you, I'll just offer you 3 bottles of Scotch. And you'll say, well, you know, I'll take 5. And we'll settle on 4. And I hand you the 4 bottles of Scotch. And it's valuable to you because you like Scotch. At any moment, if you don't decide you don't want to use it as money anymore, you can drink it. and you'll like it. Okay? Now, the problem with using scotch as money, there's several. As long as there's a market for it, as long as people want to drink it, it will have value. Scotch drinkers can drink it or they can trade it, but the value is going to depend on supply and demand. How much do they like this scotch? Maybe a better scotch comes out and they prefer that, and they're not interested in paying $1,100 per bottle. So the price can vary with supply and demand. But another problem is scotch is very heavy, and it comes in glass bottles, and if you drop them, your money's gone. Okay, unless you get on the ground and start licking very quickly, it's all gone. Okay? So you can't carry it around easily. So I have a proposal for you. The proposal is we're going to create a scotch bank. And what you're going to do is, so you don't have to carry around all these bottles, you're going to take them to the bank. And you're going to deposit them in the bank, and they're going to make a ledger entry. But to prove, so you can prove to other people that you have the scotch, they're going to let you keep the label. For every bottle you deposit, they're going to let you take the label off, and you can put the label in your wallet. And now you can walk around with something that you've already figured out. It looks just like banknotes, right? It's a piece of paper that has a serial number on it. Except it's not backed by the government, but it is backed by bottles of scotch. And as long as scotch is valuable, people will be willing to trade it just by trading the labels. Because if you take your label to my bank, they will give you that bottle, not me, because I don't have the label anymore. I've negotiated the scotch. Okay? This is a great idea. This is the way money used to be, except it wasn't serialized. Right? It was arrowheads and salt and stuff like that. Cowrie shells in Asia. Problem. Scotch has just become outlawed. The Department of Health has found that scotch is poisonous and possibly fatal. And they've completely outlawed it. And the authorities go to liquor stores and scotch banks and they destroy all the scotch. But of course you've still got your labels, don't you? All right. You got your labels. What's going to happen to the value of the labels if they're no longer backed by scotch bottles? Well, scotch lovers aren't going to consider those labels too valuable anymore because they can't redeem them for scotch that they can drink. So the value is going to decline, but it's not going to decline to zero. And there are all kinds of psychological reasons and economic reasons that that's true. It won't go to zero. It'll go to something. Okay? Let's suppose it went way down, maybe by a factor of 10. Okay? So now I'm going to create a virtual currency based on these labels. You can see that we're kind of converging on Bitcoin here. Let's assume that one label isn't worth 1,100 Hong Kong anymore like it used to be, but it's worth 100 Hong Kong. Okay? Still, if you're a wealthy person and you have lots and lots of these labels, you can't carry them all around with you. You wouldn't want to because a thief could take them. So here's what we're going to do. And furthermore, you can't even spend them on the internet. So I'm at an online store and it asks for, you know, 15 labels. There's no slot on my computer that I can stick these labels in that'll work. So let's virtualize the labels. Let's get rid of the piece of paper completely, and let's just store the serial numbers in an app on your cell phone. So here's an array that has a whole bunch of Johnny Walker Scotch serial numbers. Of course, they don't correspond to any Johnny Walker bottles anymore because they've all been destroyed. But each of these rows in here is worth $100. Okay? Now, to spend a label, all you have to do is send its number over the internet to the recipient or bump phones as long as there's an app. But when you bump them, it'll erase one row of my matrix and it'll stick a row in yours. So you'll have it. Okay? Problem with that is you might double spend. Unless there's a trusted piece of software which is guaranteed to delete the line when you spend it. As long as it's still there, you could possibly spend it again. But if we had a trusted app that guaranteed that the same line couldn't exist in more than one phone at one time, I think we'd be okay. The problem is, how does the recipient know that it's genuine? That you didn't make up the number? Well, again, we might rely on the trusted app for that. Who's going to control the issuance of these numbers, though? In the past, it was Johnny Walker. When they made the scotch bottles, they put the numbers on. But now that no scotch bottles are being made anymore, where does this money come from? Can it ever inflate? Can the money supply ever expand? And if so, then you have to have a trusted authority who's going to issue the number. What's going to stop forgery? And there are some solutions to this, and these solutions are used in Bitcoin. One is, make the creation of the numbers very expensive. So to create a valid number, you would have to do a massive amount of work, and it would be expensive. Another is that you should be able to limit the generation of numbers to a fixed quantity of serial numbers, otherwise there'd be unbounded inflation. People would just keep generating these numbers, and eventually they'd be worthless, because there'd be so many of them. The world would be flooded with them. This is what happened in the Weimar Republic in Germany, when to buy a loaf of bread you had to carry around a wheelbarrow full of Deutschmarks, because they were essentially worthless. Okay. Now, to avoid the government from controlling all this, I mean, the government already did its damage when they destroyed those scotch bottles. Scotch drinkers are not happy with this. To make sure they can't mess up the system anymore, let's not have a central registry, but let's maintain the ownership records, these transfer records, in a distributed network. So when I spend one of my labels with you, a broadcast will be made to thousands of nodes around the world that says that I did that. And so many, many people independently will keep records of these transfers. And the government can't stop that. The government can't really necessarily even audit that. Okay? Now we're ready to talk about Bitcoin. And so I have to spend two slides on some mildly difficult mathematical material. I have to. I apologize. I have to talk about what hash functions are. So this represents a character string in a computer. So a character string might be 3 bytes long, it might be a megabyte, it might be a terabyte. Who knows? It's a string of characters. A hash function is a transformation that's made on character strings that results in a short value of fixed length. It is wrong to consider a hash to be a compression of the original string. The reason that's wrong is that you can't go backwards from the hash and reconstruct the original. If it were a true compression, you would be able to go backwards. It's not a compression. Okay? So, because the hash is much shorter than the message, many messages must hash to the same thing. Eventually you're going to repeat. Okay? So a hash produces a fixed size string, usually in the range these days of 128 to 512 bits. Now, this is the last complicated slide. A one-way hash function is a hash that is easy to compute, but incredibly difficult to invert, where invert means finding any message or string that would hash to the value you're looking at. It's easy to produce the hash, but incredibly difficult to find a string that will hash to that. If one-way hash functions exist, then they can be used for security purposes in financial systems. And in fact, hash functions, one-way hashes do exist, and they're used in Bitcoin. So if this is a message that we want to make unalterable so it can't be forged or modified, we pass it through a hash function, and now we get this smaller string. That's easy to do, but it's incredibly difficult to go backwards. And when I say incredibly difficult, it means it's not literally impossible. Mathematically, it can't be impossible, because I could just start with the zero string, all zero bits, and cycle through every string there is, and eventually I'm going to find a string that hashes to that value. You could do it. But if it takes a million years, not much chance it'll happen in our lifetime. So it's pretty secure. Bitcoin uses a well-known and published open-source hash function called SHA-256. Stands for Secure Hash Algorithm. SHA-256 produces 256-bit hashes. And here's the level of security of SHA-256. No one has ever found two strings that hash to the same value. And it's not for lack of trying. The reason is that the number of different hashes is 2 to the 256th. That number is so large, it's vastly greater than the number of atoms in the Earth. Okay? And so the possibility of our finding two strings that point to the same atom on Earth is so negligible that we can pretty much figure it's not going to happen. I don't know what the National Security Agency is doing, but I know that no one has announced that they have found any two strings that hash to the same thing are referred to as a collision. No one has ever announced that they have found a collision in SHA-256. But if they did, it would be very easy for any of us to verify it. All they would have to do is publish the two values that they claim hash to the same thing, and everybody in the room could compute the hash and verify that. Okay? Well, now we can talk about Bitcoin. What is a Bitcoin? It does not correspond to any physical object, and what might surprise you is it doesn't even correspond to a bit string, a character string. You might think that if you buy a Bitcoin, for example, at a retail store in Hong Kong, if you buy a Bitcoin and they give you some wallet software and they do something in there, that somehow that Bitcoin is in your digital wallet, that there's some representation of a coin in there that you're carrying around with you. This is not true. It's a fiction. A Bitcoin is, it's in red, Bitcoin is a chain of digitally signed transaction records leading from the original owner to the current holder. It's just like a sequence of land deeds, except that that chain of transactions is not held in a central registry, it's held in many places in a worldwide distributed network. That's what a Bitcoin is. But you don't have that chain. You don't need that chain. That chain is sitting around in the network in many places. What you need is the ability to grant a deed. You need the ability to add to that chain. You don't need to have the chain. The chain itself is not a Bitcoin. Bitcoin is a pointer to the owner of the Bitcoin. Now, if you have a wallet with a Bitcoin in it, what you have is software that will permit you to add a new deed, that is, to transfer the Bitcoin, which doesn't exist, to transfer the Bitcoin to somebody else, and when that happens, a record of that will be transmitted to all of these distributed nodes. Now, I haven't told you what they're going to do with it yet, but that's what a Bitcoin is. It's very similar to a chain of land deeds, except that land deeds are pieces of paper. You can hold them. You can burn them. You can go to the land registry and set it on fire, and then nobody would know who owned anything. Okay, Bitcoin doesn't have that property. The records don't correspond to anything physical. Now, what's in these transaction records? Well, you don't want these transaction records to be easily forgeable. So you have to make it really difficult to make a transaction record genuine. And the transaction records contain hashes that are very difficult to find. And they're found by people called Bitcoin miners, and we'll talk about that in a minute. They also contain virtual owner IDs called Bitcoin addresses. Now, a Bitcoin address, unlike your home address, doesn't uniquely identify you. A person can have as many different Bitcoin addresses as they want to. In every different transaction, for example, you can make up a different address. When I ask you to pay me and you to pay me, I can have you send money to one address and you send money to another address, but I control both of them, and nobody in the world knows that I control both of them. This is a fundamental problem with Bitcoin, actually, is that it's very easy for people to manipulate alone. They don't need confederates. So if I want to push the value of Bitcoin up, all I do is sell some to myself, and nobody knows that I'm selling them to myself. And as the transaction records are published, it looks like the value of the Bitcoins are going up and up and up. And people get all excited, and they figure they're missing out on something. So they go buy more Bitcoins, and the value keeps going up. And then at some point I decide I've had enough fun, and I sell mine. And I've just made a profit at everybody else's expense. And there's no way to detect that somebody is selling a Bitcoin to himself. Okay? There's no Bitcoin centralized registry, and these Bitcoin chains are broadcast to everybody, well, everybody who's running the Bitcoin client. Anybody can verify them. So once the transaction records are published, anybody can look at the transaction records and verify that they indeed lead from the original owner all the way to the present owner. You don't know who that is, because all he's identified by is a character string, which is an address. And he may have many such addresses. And it's legal to do that. Okay? Now, Bitcoin works according to the Bitcoin protocol, which was invented in 2008, or at least published in 2008, by an anonymous person or team that goes under the apparent pseudonym Satoshi Nakamoto. We don't believe this is a real person. We just don't know the size of the team that did this work. Now, the Bitcoin protocol is for generating and exchanging Bitcoin. It's implemented in publicly available open source software. If you're suspicious about the protocol, go read the code and satisfy yourself that there's nothing untoward going on in there. Okay? Anybody can obtain and run a free Bitcoin client. You can run it on your PC, you know, if you'd like to. Now, this is the meat of the presentation. This is how Bitcoin works. It takes three slides to do this. And at the end, you should understand what the mechanism is. But remember, keeping in mind what a Bitcoin is, it is a chain of ownership of something that does not exist. Important to remember that. And we're always going to be looking for that chain of ownership. That's what's going on here. Okay. So I'll start out over here with my laser pointer. Why did it do that? All right. Bob, an online merchant, decides to begin accepting bitcoins as payment. We haven't talked about where they come from yet. So we're going to assume that some people have Bitcoin, which they do, and a merchant is willing to accept Bitcoin. Okay? Well, later on we'll talk about where they come from. Alice, who wants to buy something from Bob, has some Bitcoins and wants to purchase merchandise from Bob. So, Bob and Alice both have Bitcoin wallets on their computers. Now remember what these wallets are going to contain. One thing they do not contain is Bitcoins. Bitcoins don't exist. Bitcoins are nowhere. Okay, they're not in some secret place. They're not in the cloud. They don't exist. The only thing that exists is a chain of ownership to this nothing. The chain of ownership does exist. Okay? It sounds funny, but that's the way it really is. Okay? So Bob and Alice both have Bitcoin wallets. What Bitcoin wallets permit them to do through software is to spend Bitcoin by adding to the chain of title and to accept Bitcoin by being a recipient of the chain of title. Okay? Now, wallets are files that provide access to multiple Bitcoin addresses. This is a correct statement. Notice it doesn't say it provides access to Bitcoins. It provides access to Bitcoin addresses. So, for example, Alice may have Bitcoin that have been chained to multiple different addresses. She could have given a different address to everybody who ever gave her a Bitcoin. And all that's kept track of in her wallet. And she can spend the coins separately if she wants to, by giving 10 of them to Bob. Okay, and all of them are going to have different start addresses. And depending on how Alice and Bob negotiate, they may have different ending addresses too. Bob may say, send 3 of them to this address, 2 of them to that address, etc. Okay? Now, an address is a string of letters and numbers, such as, I'm not going to bother reading that. Okay? It's a character string, and I'll tell you what it is later. Each address says has its own balance of Bitcoin. Well, what that really means is each address is the terminus of a chain of title to some number of Bitcoins. It may be the terminus of multiple chains of title. But you could, if you had all the chains of title, you could figure out exactly how many Bitcoin correspond to this address if you wanted to. Okay? Now, creating a new address. Since Bob just started taking Bitcoin, he doesn't have any Bitcoin addresses yet. So Bob creates a new Bitcoin address for Alice to send her payments to. Well, he doesn't actually create it. It's the software that he's running that creates it. Okay? And fundamentally, a Bitcoin address is a public key corresponding to an elliptic curve cryptography public-private key pair, if you care. Okay? Now, this is very strange. But you're probably right, but I don't want to interrupt and try to take it off the timer. Okay, submitting a payment. Alice tells her Bitcoin client that she'd like to transfer the purchase account to Bob's address. So Bob sends her the address, which he can do in the clear over the internet if he wants to. Please send Bitcoin to this address. And so Alice, if she wants, types in the address. Actually, it's much easier because it'll be exchanged by software. But she just types in that address that Bob gives her and hits send. And the software will then do what it needs to do. Alice's wallet holds the private key for each of her addresses. So there's a public-private key pair. Each address is a public key. Corresponding to that is a private key. The wallet knows those keys. She doesn't. I mean, they're long. She would never remember them. And if she wrote them down, they would be subject to loss. So they just sit in the wallet. The Bitcoin client signs her transaction request with the private key of the address she's transferring Bitcoins from. That proves it's coming from her. Now, anyone on the network can now use the public key, her address, to verify that the transaction request is actually coming from Alice. Okay? Well, not from Alice, but from that address that Alice is using. Her name doesn't show up anywhere. Okay? So it's easy to verify the transaction. Now, we want to publish these transaction records, but it's important to make them non-forgeable. So this is where the Bitcoin miners come into play. Gary, Garth, and Glenn are Bitcoin miners. They are going to verify the transaction. And the way they do that is, because it's expensive to verify a transaction, you don't do them one by one. You bundle a bunch. You wait 10 minutes for all the transactions in Bitcoin that there are in the world, and you bundle those together, and you're going to create a joint deed record associated with each one of those things. And what they do then is bundle the transactions of the past 10 minutes into something that's referred to as a transaction block. So you can see here there are a bunch of arrows. Each of those represents a transfer of some number of Bitcoin from an owner to a recipient. Owner, recipient, owner, recipient. The miners' computers are set up to calculate cryptographic hash functions, SHA-256. What they're required to do is to add in a value into this transaction block such that the hash is below a certain threshold number. And if it's the lower and lower and lower the number gets, the problem is it takes a lot of work trying all kinds of random strings in order to find a value that's going to be that low. For example, suppose I told you that all hashes produced uniformly distributed values between 0 and 1. And I require a valid hash to be less than 1/1,000,000th. Well, you would expect you'd have to try a million different hashes to get one below a millionth. Now suppose it's below a trillionth. Now you've got to try a trillion of them. Suppose I tell you that it's got to be below 10 to the minus 15th. Now you have to try 10 to the 15th of them. And that's something that your laptop is probably not going to be capable of doing in any reasonable time. Okay? So they do this work. This is called mining. One of these guys is eventually going to come up with a value such that the hash of it eventually produces the right value below a certain threshold. Okay? So the mining computers calculate new hash values based on... this hasn't happened all year. Now it happens tonight. Okay. At 30 seconds. Okay. They calculate new hash values based on a combination of the previous hash value, the new transaction block, and a nonce. This nonce is the number, the random number that they keep trying until they get the correct hash value below a certain threshold. Okay? Now, creating hashes is computationally trivial, but the Bitcoin system requires that the new hash value have a particular form. Specifically, it must start with a certain number of zeros. Well, that means it's small. The more zeros it has to start with, the smaller it is. Okay? Now we move over here. The miners have no way to predict which nonce, which random number they pick, is going to produce the right hash. They have no alternative but to try loads of them. And when I say loads, I mean 10 to the 14th, 10 to the 15th of them. Okay? They won't produce a hash value with the required number of leading zeros, so they're forced to generate many hashes with different nonces until they happen upon one that works. When that happens, they get paid for their work. Right now, they get 25 Bitcoin. Last year, they got 50 Bitcoin. And the number goes down at a known predictable rate. Eventually, they're not going to get paid anything. And the question is, why are they going to do it at that time? And the reason that they will verify Bitcoin is they'll get paid for that. There will be a verifier fee. Right now, they get paid by having Bitcoin issued to them. And so they create a block that has 25 Bitcoin, then it belongs to them, to their address. They then publish that a transaction has been verified by them, and everybody else in the network can verify that that's correct. Now, what about all these other guys that are also madly trying to earn those 25 Bitcoin? Too bad. The first guy wins. Anybody who manages to succeed with that later is not going to get paid for this transaction block. He's not going to get paid for any other transaction block either, because that nonce that he picked isn't going to work on a different transaction block. You're going to have to start all over again. Okay? Now, Alice's, it says, as time goes on, Alice's transfer to Bob, that's it there, gets buried beneath other more recent transactions. For anyone to modify the details, suppose somebody decided that Alice's Bitcoin, instead of going to Bob, I'd like to make it go to me. So I'm going to go and try to modify the chain of deeds. Well, in the land registry, it's easy. You get some chemicals and erase the ink and you forge something. Here, it's not easy. Because what you'd have to do is, every transaction block, you'd have to redo the work necessary to find that random number which is going to cause the hash to be low. And you'd have to do it for this block and that block and that block and that block. And there's no way that a forger could ever reproduce all of that work. That's where the inherent security of the system lies. Is the essentially the impossibility of modifying or forging the chain of title. Okay? Now, the Bitcoin software is what generates these addresses. And these addresses are 25 to 44 characters long. There's one that looks like that. Because of elliptic curve cryptography, one of these, if it's 44 characters as long, is as secure as a 7,000-bit RSA key. And with recent revelations about the relationship between RSA and the National Security Agency, it's not clear how secure a 7,000-bit RSA key is, but nobody uses 7,000-bit keys. They're just much too long. I mean, maybe the military does, but civilians don't use them. So to send Bitcoin, you just specify a receiving address, an amount, and you click send. To receive them, you just tell the sender your address. Addresses are not registered to users. There's no place you can go and look up and find that this address corresponds to that person. Even if armies of prosecutors come with subpoenas and demand to know who belongs to that address, you can't answer because you don't know. Maybe the true owner can answer, but she won't. She won't tell the truth, and there's no way to prove. Okay? Now, the mining. That's what these guys do to verify the transaction blocks. They try many different hash values, 10 to the 15th or so, and the success that they encounter is rewarded with Bitcoin. The threshold declines over time, making it more and more difficult, but also the payment gets lower over time. And there will never be more than 21 million Bitcoin. And so in order for them to be fungible and be able to spend them for small items, you don't have to transfer Bitcoin in whole units. You can transfer them in units as small as 1/100,000,000th of a Bitcoin. Okay? Now, this is the control of Bitcoin inflation. You saw that curve in the video. This shows over time how many Bitcoin there can be. And it asymptotically reaches 21 million. We'll never exceed that. And that's built into the software. There's nothing you can do to change it. If you try to modify the client, it's not going to work. Okay? Now, Bitcoin mining in Hong Kong. You may or may not know that there is a secret Hong Kong facility that uses boiling goo to mine Bitcoins. Now, it's computationally very difficult to do 10 to the 15th computations in a relatively small number of minutes. Because Bitcoins have become so valuable, people have invested huge amounts of money in computer centers that utilize special hardware that is designed to compute SHA-256 hashes in hardware very fast. And this guy is proud of his computer center because it's liquid-cooled. Okay, it says, the mine is the size of a shipping container and filled with 1-meter-high glass tanks in which banks of blade servers, are immersed in rolling liquid. Each tank can hold 92 blades. The blades themselves are kept at a temperature of 30 degrees C or below by open bath immersion technology. Actually, the greatest density of Bitcoin mining in the world is now in Iceland. There are huge, sparse, heavily guarded facilities in Iceland. It's easy to keep things cool in Iceland, much easier than to keep them cool in Hong Kong. Okay? And, of course, if you get rewarded with 25 Bitcoin every time you verify a transaction, 25 Bitcoin is worth $15,000 U.S. today. And so it's worth it if you do it a lot. Okay? Of course, as the value of Bitcoin goes down, if it does, then it won't be profitable to run these computer centers anymore. Well, this is a picture of the Bitcoin value from September 11, 2011 to now. And you can see for most of the time it was real lame. So when I started teaching about Bitcoin 2 years ago, it was worth $5 US. One year ago, when I gave the course in Hong Kong, it was worth $15. Now it's worth 650 or more U.S. dollars. And you can see that. It was completely flat here. Yeah, there's some random signals. Okay, it goes up like this. There's a little spike there, and then whoa. So let's look at the detail of what's happened recently. This is just from last October to now. It started out pretty low. It peaked at U.S. $1,238 on December 4th. It went way down the next day when the PRC announced that it was restricting banks from owning or holding Bitcoin. Then, up and down. Zynga, the game maker, decided to accept Bitcoin the day after that, so it went up. Then, the Bitcoin China exchange stopped taking RMB deposits, so mainlanders couldn't buy Bitcoin, and so the value went way down. Then it went up a little bit, and then Alibaba banned it, it went down again. And we go around to here. And then there was a huge denial of service attack on multiple Bitcoin exchanges in the middle of February, and the value started declining. And then Mt. Gox announced this $400 million theft of Bitcoin on February 25th, but it's bounced back since then. It went up 20% on Monday. Now, how can there be theft? We've got all of these transaction records. We've got these chains of title held in thousands of computers around the world. How can I show up and steal anything? Well, the answer is certainly not by changing the transaction records. You can't do that. But notice, it's the wallet that holds the public and private keys. And if you're like many people who buy things from an exchange, like if you buy stock on a stock exchange, usually you allow your broker to hold the certificates. You don't actually take delivery of the certificates, because then you'd have to put them in a safe deposit box in a bank. Okay? Well, it's the same thing with Bitcoin exchanges. In Mt. Gox, people would buy Bitcoin, but they allowed the wallet to be held by Mt. Gox, the exchange. And so when hackers were able to break into the system, they got access to the public and private key pairs, and if you know the private key, you can digitally sign a transaction record that looks like it came from Alice. Now, Mt. Gox finally revealed that the theft had taken place over a period of years. It wasn't like in one day somebody took $400 million. What they were doing was slowly spiriting Bitcoin out of Mt. Gox. And because of the very features of Bitcoin that people love, namely the untraceability, the inability of government to audit, inability of the police to trace anything, they can't get the money back. It's gone. They just have to accept that it's gone. Thieves got it. It's like if thieves break into your house and take money or valuables and the police never catch them, it's gone. But at least with physical things, there's some chance that the police can get them. There are video cameras and their fingerprints and, you know, footprints and stuff like that. There's evidence. Here, no. Okay, the $400 million isn't coming back, and that's why Mt. Gox eventually had to declare bankruptcy. So apparent theft at Mt. Gox shakes the Bitcoin world. Okay. Now, what are the vulnerabilities in Bitcoin? You've seen some of them. Well, there's no way to reverse a transaction without the payee's cooperation. So if I mistakenly transfer Bitcoin to you, there's nothing I can do to get it back. I have to ask you nicely, would you please return the Bitcoin? And if you don't, I have to resort to the court system to sue you. Transaction malleability. You'll see this in a lot of news articles. It's not exactly clear what it means. I mean, a metal is malleable if you can pound it down, right, and make it thin. But in the context of Bitcoin, it means alterability. Is it possible to alter transaction records? And in general, it isn't. But it's possible to create erroneous transaction records or unauthorized ones if I happen to know the private key of the owner. And that's the way the thefts have been occurring. In general, you should wait 60 minutes. If there's a very large transaction, you want to wait 60 minutes so enough nodes around the world broadcast that they have indeed verified the transaction. So that even though the transfer is instantaneous, the verification of the transfer is not instantaneous. Software bugs can occur. This may not be a protocol failure. The Bitcoin proselytizers will tell you that there's absolutely nothing wrong with the Bitcoin protocol, that every time something bad happens, it's because of bad implementation. And they may be right. So there can be bugs in the software that's used by the exchanges. There could be bugs in your wallet software, for example. There can certainly be vulnerabilities that would allow hackers to break in. Bank robbery by hackers, we already talked about. Malware attacks against your wallet. There are certainly going to be viruses that propagate to cell phones and look around for Bitcoin wallets and try to do things with them. There's just no doubt that these things are going to exist. Governments have attempted to control Bitcoin. Silk Road was raided by the US FBI in October 2013 because Bitcoin was being used to finance illegal transactions. And governments are, however, quite stymied about this. So when Mt. Gox went bankrupt, the Japanese regulators were kind of left looking at each other and looking not so smart. And so they announced today that they plan to tax Bitcoin transactions. But in the same news conference where they said that, they admitted that they absolutely have no way of doing that. So they can impose a tax, but they can't collect the tax. So what they can do is, it would be, if you transfer Bitcoin and you don't pay the tax, you become a criminal. But it's their problem to prove that you did that. And if they can't prove that you did it, then they can't prosecute you. Some countries have banned Bitcoin outright. Because, of course, Bitcoin is a potential alternative currency that is outside the purview of the government to control. They can't control the money supply. So if there are all these Bitcoin and we're exchanging them for goods and services, they act like money, but they cause some degree of inflation, deflation with the money supply. The regulators lose control over the money supply. They don't like that. They also lose control over traceability, proving that, for example, you can commit now the perfect kidnapping. The way you do it is, you've seen movies in which people get kidnapped. The kidnappers always get caught when they go to pick up the cash. Well, now you don't have to pick up the cash. What I do is, my ransom note says, transfer $100 million worth of Bitcoin to these addresses. Okay? And it's untraceable now. And I can assure you that the legal authorities cannot stand a situation in which kidnappers can get away with a perfect crime. They're just not going to allow it. They just haven't figured out a way to not allow it. So PRC has banned banks from holding Bitcoin. Russia has done the same thing. The Hong Kong Monetary Authority has a different attitude, which is, it's not money, so we don't have the authority to regulate it. It is a traded product. Well, you laugh. The Scotch whiskey example we were talking about. Suppose we were doing stuff with, we were exchanging Scotch whiskey in return for goods and services. Would the HKMA step in and say, we have the right to regulate Scotch? No, it's some other authority that has the right to regulate alcoholic beverages. Okay? So it is a traded product. It is not money. Yes. A question from one of my students in my electronic payments course.
So I actually tried to sign up for a Bitcoin address.
Yes.
What happened was that it asked for a lot of identification documents of mine, like my ID card and everything. So it seems to me that my address is linked with my identity.
Don't sign up there. No, there are certain institutions which try to comply with the law, and they, in the U.S. we have a Know Thy Customer law for banks. Banks, you can't go in with cash and open a bank account. You have to identify yourself, you have to give a social security number, etc. If you don't want a bank account, then don't go to a bank. But if you don't want to be identified. And so you're dealing with the wrong guys. You need to meet the criminal element, and they will assist you in remaining anonymous. Okay. Now, another problem with Bitcoin, however, is that competing digital currencies are very easy to create. Here's my proposal. We take the Bitcoin client software, we rename it Bitcoin 2, and we change some parameters in there so it's as if it were day zero, and we start all over again. And so you got some Bitcoins, and now you got some Bitcoin 2s. Now, why would one prefer one to the other? And in fact, there are at least 20 different competitors of Bitcoin now. None of them has achieved the notoriety or the level of investment, but they're out there. And there's nothing to stop this. There's no patent. There's no copyright. It's open source. You know, you do what you want with it. So, Hong Kong Monetary Authority says it won't regulate Bitcoin. First physical Bitcoin retail store opens in Hong Kong. This was a couple of days ago. And people have been buying. I met somebody a little while ago who bought, I think, 0.07 of a Bitcoin. He didn't want to put his life savings into it. Okay, he wanted to put a few dollars into it, just for the experience. And now, I'll end with this. Octopus plus Bitcoin, ? Bitcoin spreads tentacles as octopus sniffs the bait. Get it? Tentacles, octopus. Okay. So Octopus chief executive Sunny Chung Yutong said, the firm does not rule out accepting Bitcoin someday. Even as an HKMA official argued, it's a virtual commodity, not a virtual currency. Okay? Heated debate took place at the Asian Financial Forum on Bitcoin, Even Octopus, which operates a smart card payment system across the SAR, showed interest, and So we don't know. Some governments are taking a very laissez-faire attitude, saying, we don't know where this is going. Let's see what the natural development is. Other countries are saying, we see danger in this, and we want to stop it right now until we can get a better handle on it. But I've talked to very few people who are interested in financial policy who have any real clue about what a Bitcoin really is. They think a Bitcoin is like electronic cash, which is represented by bit strings, literally bit strings that you can look at and you can see how much their value is. There is no such thing for a Bitcoin. Anyway, here's my proposal. I'm going to play the video again. And my belief is that you will have an entirely different level of understanding of the video the second time. It lasts less than 2 minutes.
What is Bitcoin?
Now you know.
Bitcoin is the first decentralized digital currency. Bitcoins are digital coins you can send through the internet. Compared to other
alternatives, not really.
Bitcoins have a number of advantages. Bitcoins are transferred directly from person to person via the net without going through a bank or clearinghouse. This means that the fees are much lower, you can use them in every country, your account cannot be frozen, and there are no prerequisites or arbitrary limits. Let's look at how it works. Bitcoins are generated all over the internet by anybody running a free application called a Bitcoin miner. Mining requires a certain amount of work for each block of coins. This amount is automatically adjusted by the network such that Bitcoins are always created at a predictable and limited rate. Your Bitcoins are stored in your digital wallet, which might look familiar if you
use really.
Bank. When you transfer Bitcoins, an electronic signature is added. After a few minutes, the transaction is verified by a miner and permanently and anonymously stored in the network. The Bitcoin software is completely open source and anybody can review the code. Bitcoin is changing finance the same way the web changed publishing. When everyone has access to a global market, great ideas flourish. Let's look at some examples of how Bitcoins are already used today. You can purchase video games, gifts, books, servers, and alpaca socks. Several currency exchanges exist where you can trade your Bitcoins for dollars, euros, and more. Bitcoins are a great way for small businesses and freelancers to get noticed. It doesn't cost anything to start accepting them, there are no chargebacks or fees, and you'll get additional business from the Bitcoin economy. For your first Bitcoins and more information, visit weusecoins.com.
And with that, I thank you for your attention. I'll be happy to take questions.